and welcome to My Psychotherapy Career, a podcast where we explore the different therapeutic settings our members work in and how they came into their career. I am Jenna Rashid, the Digital Engagement Officer at UKCP. Our host, Helen Willingham, is the Head of Content Engagement at UKCP, overseeing all our communications to members and the public, as well as our policy and research work. In this episode, Helen speaks to UKCP psychotherapist Melissa Cliff. Melissa began her career in the marketing and events industry before qualifying in 2008 as a psychotherapist. She has a particular interest in issues relating to midlife and ageing, which has recently drawn her to begin her PhD. Her research focuses on how female therapists and female clients work with experiences related to physical appearance. Melissa works in private practice and as a teacher at Metanoia. She continues to take on new and exciting opportunities that draw on her psychotherapeutic expertise. In this episode, we speak to Melissa about her journey into research and what advice she would share to fellow psychotherapists and psychotherapeutic counsellors looking to start their PhD and get into research.
And thank you for joining me today as well, Melissa. It's going to be really great to talk to you and all about your career. I want to start with, before you were a psychotherapist, as you previously worked in marketing, what made you move into psychotherapeutic training and change career?
Well, for me, my interest started quite a long time ago. I have kept personal diaries since about the age of 13, and I have diary entries from around the age of 16 where I say, I want to be a shrink. You know, at that time, I didn't know the difference between a shrink, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a psychotherapist, or a counselor. But quite early on, I had a hunger and an interest in this. And, you know, I think that I was always somebody who felt things quite deeply. I was quite sensitive to other people's feelings and emotions and pain. And I was maybe quite an intense or a deep thinker and quite reflective naturally. And I think, you know, 9 months old, my family had moved. And I think I always had a sense of being somewhere else, was interested in, you know, what helped people to belong and fit and so forth. So there was something, you know, quite early on that appealed to me about this kind of work. And I think I knew as well that I couldn't just become a psychotherapist, you know, start training at a very young age, maybe 18 or, you know, or fresh out of university. I knew that I needed to have some life experience first, and I wanted to do some other things before that. And so, you know, after I finished university, I did a number of different jobs, but, you know, I ended up working in marketing and events. You know, it was great in many ways because it was a creative environment. It was a very social environment. I had opportunities to manage people, to run campaigns. In lots of ways, it was fantastic, but it was also, you know, in terms of time, it was very demanding. There was a very tough workload. We were always, you know, trying to service the needs of our clients, often on short deadlines and low, you know, and tight budgets. And it just was clear to me that although I had got a lot from this job, it wasn't something that I wanted to do long term. I needed to do something that felt more meaningful for me. And so there came a point where I started to think about psychotherapy again. And, you know, fortunately, there was a colleague of mine who had left and had gone on to do a training in Nottingham with the Sherwood Institute. And she had an absolutely fantastic time on her training. And we talked a lot about that. And she recommended it to me. And it was a Gestalt psychotherapy training. And I thought it sounded brilliant. And so I applied. I did an interview. I got on the course. And that was it. From that point on, I was on the pathway to becoming a psychotherapist. And I suppose you could say I haven't looked back since.
You know, I don't think it's a career that's yet on people's I want to be lists. It often is that second career, but you had that recognition that you needed the life experience first. Did you feel like you'd kind of got to that point where you'd got the life experience that meant, yes, actually training was the right next step? Or was it really just, this sounds great, I'm going to just go for it?
It was a bit of both. There was a partly, I can't do this job any longer, I have to get out and do something else. You know, there was life was getting uncomfortable enough that I knew I had to change. But it was a bit like this, something that was always around in the background. And maybe, you know, now I've done it, so, you know, it feels like it was maybe more of a path of destiny. You know, I didn't know that then. And it was an idea that I thought, oh, maybe I could do this. Maybe this is something I could do. There was a massive leap of faith when I actually did it, because it was sort of trusting something that I'd felt for a long time. But there was something about psychotherapy that I guess it was quite persistent, maybe more persistent than other dreams that I had had, or other potential careers. And so I think when I got to that crunch point, it was almost like it was there waiting for, like, okay, now it's time. And I'm glad I had had the other life experience. And what's been interesting is that when I started my training, I felt like I was the only one with a business or commercial background. And you know, I was a bit insecure about that, and it felt like there were all these other people who at least had some mental health experience that seemed like they were really ahead of me. But what I've found is that it's been really useful, and particularly for clients who work in these fields, that I kind of understand the language that they're talking and the pressures that they're under. And so I think none of our experience, our life experience, is wasted in this career. It's all grist for the mill, and it all helps us to relate to the people that we work with. So I'm really grateful that I did take that route, and I did take the time to, yeah, be immersed in quite a different field and have an understanding of that.
What does being a UKCP member mean to you?
For me, it's important because I think the UKCP is like a stamp that says I have done a rigorous training and I have met certain standards. And I really do believe that the training I had was rigorous, and that it's something that hopefully, you know, clients can look towards and see, you know, I feel like I can put a certain amount of trust in there. I mean, I have to live up to certain standards and ethical codes, but it's useful for them. And it's a gateway. You know, if I hadn't had UKCP accreditation, I wouldn't have been able to work with employee assistance providers, which is something I did a lot in my early psychotherapy career. And that was a really great way to build up experience and start building up a practice. I wouldn't have been able to do that without it. It also means that I can go on certain listings with, you know, counseling directory type listings, with health insurance providers, and it allows me to do those things. So in a sense, it's really helped me to build up a practice. You know, those are maybe more practical things. In other ways, you know, I have felt quite supported by UKCP, and I feel like they've also helped me in my own development and my own career by putting opportunities my way. And, you know, they put on interesting programs. You know, I think about some of the conferences and the research conferences that I've attended. I think they've been really interesting. I think UKCP has a role in terms of activism and looking out for social justice issues. And I'm glad that they, you know, take a very firm stance on. So I think that they also play a role in our society, in our culture, in terms of, you know, really promoting the values that we have as psychotherapists. I really do think that psychotherapists have a lot to offer society in terms of how we can live with each other. And I think the UKCP has a role in that.
Absolutely. Thanks, Melissa. Thinking more about your own career, what drew you to specializing in midlife aging and appearance?
Well, like most of us, our interests connect with our own experiences. And so, you know, I'm here, I'm talking to you, and I'm in my early 50s now. And there was a point at which, you know, I was really going through a midlife passage. And I can remember thinking to myself, okay, is this it? I had a, you know, lots of nice things going on in my life, but, you know, I have a nice family and a good practice. And I thought, well, I could just live out the rest of my life and maybe nothing could change. And there was a sense of thinking, well, oh gosh, actually, I want life to feel a bit more adventurous again, or I want to some more excitement or difference, or it felt like it needed some kind of shaking up. And obviously in midlife, you know, other things happen. So, you know, biologically, you know, going through perimenopause, and that brought lots of changes and challenges with it too. And so during that time, I was looking to understand that experience a bit better. And I came across, you know, writers like Sharon Blackie, Clarissa Pinkola Estes, who were writing about midlife and older age using the language of myth. And that was really interesting. And I found the way that they wrote was hopeful, and they made it sound exciting. And I suppose I really wanted to see this as a life stage that has opportunity, adventure, excitement, that we can really use this time to explore what we want out of life and how we want to live. So it started with my own experience. And then I noticed I had clients who were sometimes a little older or sometimes a similar age, who are also going through what I think of as, you know, really an existential passage, really a figuring out of who they are and what they want from life. And I was just really interested in that. I think it's one of the most fascinating processes that we can go through. You know, the questions about who am I, what do I want, are fundamental for all of us. So that really grabbed my interest. Now, when I first started looking into this, there was very, very little information about menopause. It was before Davina McCall came and did a big broadcast on Channel 4. And, you know, women really didn't know much about what was going on. And I think at the time I wrote an article about, you know, help, am I going mad? And that gained a lot of interest. I was trying to address some gap where, you know, people didn't know how to make sense of this experience. People needed information. So I was slightly responding to that. And so that extended to, you know, looking at issues related to menopause. But I think one aspect of that that really engaged me was that when you reach midlife, particularly for women, you know, this is when the first signs of aging start appearing. And most of us live in a world where we are taught that we have to look a certain way. We're given lots of ideals to live up to. And there's a real pressure around that. And I was interested in what it meant for women when their appearance started to change and the world might start to respond to you differently. And existentially, what does that mean for you? And how can you maybe grieve, you know, what might be being lost, but how can you also kind of recalibrate and think, okay, here I am as somebody who's growing older and, you know, looking older. What do I do? How do I meet that? How do I live with my aging? And that really took me into my research. And I was really interested in finding out about how other women experience these changes. And so I started to interview women about their experience and listen to their accounts. And it was just really illuminating. And what it taught me is that it actually wasn't just women in midlife who were having really complex responses to these changes, but it was women throughout the life cycle. I ended up also interviewing some younger women, and they were preparing for the time when they would look older, and they were thinking, well, maybe I would have fillers, maybe I would do this, maybe I'll be like this woman in my life who, you know, is a really great role model. And I just felt like there are lots of stories, and women seem to want to be asked about these things. They wanted a space to talk about them. And I just thought, okay, there's something very important here. There's a lot of charge around this. It feels like there are aspects of the experience that are not being talked about, and we need to give a space to these, and we need to understand what women's experiences are with regards to appearance much better. And particularly as psychotherapists, where I don't think we've talked about this enough.
You're working on your PhD now, aren't you? Is that an extension of those interviews and questions, or was that part of the PhD? Can you tell us a bit more about your research?
I can, yes. So I didn't start off thinking that I was doing a PhD. I wasn't quite sure how to approach it. And actually, I went to a UKCP research conference and I felt inspired after that to say, well, let's just do it. So I checked out how to do it ethically. And I did this rather informally, interviewing people with the view that I would, you know, write this up and share what I found and maybe write a longer piece at a later date. So I did that first. And then I reached a point where women were telling me really important things that I thought, I really want to do this justice. And I reached a point where I thought, actually, I would like more structure and more support around what I'm doing. It was later on that I chose to go down the PhD route, partly because I really wanted the help of a supervisor. I really wanted to do it rigorously, to do this justice, and so that I could share what I've been told, you know, in a way that's useful for other women. And the PhD has changed since then. I'm very early on in this pathway, I should say. You know, I'm a year in, so I really have just got to a point where I've kind of scoped up what I'm doing. I'm looking at how physical appearance is addressed between female therapists and female clients, because I've been looking at what's missing in our literature, what hasn't been addressed yet. And this seems to be an area that hasn't had any attention. Specifically, you know, if you're thinking of female clients and female therapists have both had these experience of having to learn how to be in the world, which puts so much emphasis on physical appearance. What happens when they're together? Is it helpful that they've had these experiences? Have therapists worked through their own experiences? Have they processed these things? I just wanted to know more about what are we doing at the moment? What are we doing well? What can we learn from? So it's really just to kind of try and capture what is going on right now. And hopefully that will help us in the future to think about, you know, what do we need in terms of supervision, in terms of our own work? What do we need in terms of training and so forth?
And you said you're in the kind of scoping phase, but how did you go about starting up and getting it up and running?
Pre-PhD, I spent a lot of time living with these questions and thinking about what is it I want to know, and having a notebook always with me and writing down when I had ideas, what are the questions I want to ask people. So I did a lot of thinking around that. And then in some ways, setting up the interviews wasn't too difficult. I put something on my website about the fact that I was doing this work. Were people interested in getting in touch to talk about their experiences? And so some people came through there. Some people came through personal networks because they heard I was doing this work and they wanted to talk about it. So that wasn't actually as difficult to find people as I thought it might be, because there is an interest. On the PhD pathway, now that I'm on that, what I've done is a kind of a more extensive literature review, which I'm still working on, but it's really looking at what is out there, what is known, what has been said already. Where are the gaps? Where can I add something interesting? Where can I add something original? So there's been a lot of work that's gone into that. I've had to change my focus a bit because initially I was interested in hearing women's stories. And actually, that does exist out there in the literature, not necessarily some of it within psychotherapy, but also some of it within psychology and other specialisms. So some of that is out there. So I've really had to narrow down and think about what is it for psychotherapy that's relevant. I've been putting a lot of thought into how I will do the research and thinking of my question and trying to think about what is the best way to answer this. So I'll be looking at doing a kind of mix of quantitative and qualitative research, whereby I will be sharing surveys with female clients and female therapists. I'm going to be following up with interviews with a small selection. And then I plan to do a focus group later on to look at all the findings and to talk with supervisors. Okay, this is what we're being told. And what does this mean for us as a profession? So there's a number of stages, but I'm really at the point of really trying to sharpen the questions in my surveys, because that's the first stage and everything hinges on that. So there's a lot of kind of front loading the work, if you like. And I guess my hope is that if I've done a lot of really good preparation, then the next stages will follow from that.
And how do you balance working on your PhD and working, because you've still got practice and clients alongside, haven't you?
I wish I could say I had everything worked out and I have a fantastic routine that I follow every day and it works seamlessly. It's not like that. I'm always learning and I'm always having to adapt and I'm having to be very fluid. So I have a private practice and I also teach on an MSc program as well. So there is a lot to balance. The way I view it is that, you know, work happens in small increments. I think the way that I work, my own process is I work in power hours. And I've written a lot before. And what I find helpful is that I know which times of the day I am cognitively most effective, most productive. So I try to plan to do work that really requires my focus at those times. And the other thing that I do now is that I plan PhD breaks. So I will work for a while and then I will build in or schedule in a break where it's all about the PhD and I don't do anything else. So I'm rolling with it. It's not perfect, but things are moving along. So I also try and make the actual work as pleasurable as possible so that I think, great, actually, I'm going to sit in my cabin for an hour or an hour and a half, and I'm going to do some reading because it's interesting to read about. It's interesting work. You know, I come out feeling like that was actually a really enjoyable way to spend some of my evening.
And what advice would you give to someone who might be looking to do a PhD or wanting to get involved in research?
It's worth really paying attention to the questions or the curiosities that stay with you, that are persistent, that don't go away. I think each of us, because we have our own unique experience, we're going to bring different things to research. And I think this is the beauty of it. You know, what is it that for you personally really lights you up? What are you really fascinated by? What do you need to know more? And there's many ways that can come about. It might be that, you know, in your practice, there's something that challenges you and you need to learn how to deal with that. Or perhaps you're going to try and find out about something and you're not satisfied with the information that's out there. You know, you might be able to bring something new to the field. That's going to be helpful for you and it's going to be helpful for other people. So really pay attention to that. If you do have an idea that's sort of grabbing you, talk to people about it. You know, network, see what happens when you talk to others. They might spark more interest, or they might give you new ways of looking at it, or there might be networks that are useful for you to hear about. You know, for me, going to the UKCP research events were really helpful because when you hear somebody talking about their research in a passionate way, makes you think your own research ideas are possible. You know, it's been interesting starting on a PhD journey where, you know, I think PhD, you know, is something that sounds very daunting. It's clearly a lot of work. And I think all of us at some point have that thought of like, should I be doing this? Am I up to this? In the PhD community, it's so common to hear that. So, you know, don't discount yourself, you know, and think, well, there's no way I could do it. Saying that, I think you do need to be willing to be disciplined. You do need to be willing to do a lot of reading and a lot of writing. You know, there are other ways to do research that are perhaps becoming a bit more creative, and you know, people can use artwork and poetry and other things. But you know, you're not going to get away from the fact that you're going to have to do a lot of reading and a lot of synthesizing of information. So, you know, just make sure that whatever it is that you're interested in, it's something that can sustain your interest for a good amount of time. You're going to be living with it and thinking about it a lot.
And I want to take you back now to training, to your original training for psychotherapy. And looking back now, is there anything you wish you knew before you started that training?
The truth is, I don't think there is, because at the time I was going to do it. I was going to do it whatever. And so I think anything that, you know, you could have told me then, I don't know how much difference it would have made. you know, earlier in my training, I used to do calculations where I would think, oh, okay, well, if I could see 35 clients a week and I'm going to charge them this, I can earn blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I didn't realize that, you know, there's an emotional toll and there's a lot of psychological holding that goes with the work. And it's not, for me anyway, it's certainly not realistic to see 35 clients a week. You know, that might have been helpful to know. And I think anything else, I wouldn't have listened. I was going to do it anyway.
That's fair.
Yeah.
And how did you manage the kind of logistics of training and cost, time to train? Did you do it whilst you were still working, or was it something that you fully committed to?
Well, it was tough. I was working full time. I needed my income to pay for the course. That was really challenging. I was working full time for a good amount of the course. And there did come a time where that became unrealistic. You know, once I had to see more clients and supervision and do the other things that are necessary for the training, I think I initially dropped down to 4.5 days. And then at some point I dropped down to 4 days a week in order to allow me to meet all the additional requirements. And the course that I did would often take place in 5 day blocks or weekend blocks. So for some of them, I would just do them over the weekend and that didn't have as much impact, but it did mean that for about 6 years, I had very few holidays. So it was tough. By the end of the training, I did have to kind of give up my marketing job because I just wouldn't have been able to complete all my hours. And then I actually switched to working for an employee assistance provider on their helpline. And that was great because I then was able to work in a role that was connected with my training and earn some income. And then that freed me up to do some placements where I could build up my hours, finish my dissertation, you know, and actually complete everything. I had lodgers. I did all sorts of things to get myself there. I'm really glad I did. It was worth it. You know, I had to dig deep and I had to be really committed to do it.
And what advice would you give to someone who's thinking about training as a psychotherapist or a psychotherapeutic counsellor?
Well, I think when the job is great, it's the best job in the world. You know, you have shiver down the spine moments, which are just really profound and life affirming. And sometimes it's the hardest job ever. We can be challenged in a way that's difficult and we need a lot of support to do it. So, you know, be prepared for that. I would really encourage trainees to savor that training journey because I think that the time that they have on their training course is so unique and you're not probably going to experience anything like that anywhere else. I mean, thinking back to my group experience and all the things I learned, and it was such an opportunity to try things out and get to know myself and get feedback in a way that hasn't been replicated since. And I've been in groups that have been great since then, and I've learned a lot and I've had good connections, but nothing is quite like that training journey. So really savor it and really use it as an opportunity to learn about yourself and learn about the profession. Be open to opportunities because they're out there. If you are willing to put yourself out there a bit, you might be surprised by what comes back to you. I mean, I think the other advice I would give is if you're looking for a training course, to try to find one or an approach that aligns with your philosophy. There's lots of different training institutes and they're all going to have a slightly different feel to them. And, you know, go to open days, meet people who are doing the courses or teaching the courses and get to know about the philosophies that underpin their approaches and see if it resonates with you, if it feels truthful, if you can get on board with it.
And my final question, how has psychotherapeutic training changed you?
I can't put into words how much it has changed me. It's immeasurably. I mean, we started today by talking about, you know, my diaries from when I was 13. And, you know, I can still see me in that. It was still me writing them, but, you know, then I look at me here in my 50s and how different I am, and some of the differences just being older. But I think it's what I said about, you know, when I did my training, it felt like I had a way of understanding the world, and things started to make sense. As a gestaltist, you know, I pay much more attention to my present experience. You know, life is always going to be challenging. It's always going to throw up things that are difficult, but I have a much better way of being able to check in with myself, really be much clearer about what I like, what I want, what I need. I'm able to walk a pathway in life that's much more aligned with my choices. You know, I'm choosing things more than just, I guess, going along with things. You know, I think before I trained as a therapist, you know, I could be quite shy. I was quite unsure about a lot of things. Those things can still be true for me now, but I just feel a bit more supported in myself and more accepting of lots of things. I know myself better. And the other thing that's maybe an obvious one is it's allowed me to have a career that's really interesting and fascinating. And it still is. You know, I've been doing this for at least 20 years and I've done amazing things. I think I always wanted to do private practice and other things. And if I look at all the things it's allowed me to do, you know, I've worked in schools, I've worked in hospices, I've worked with employee assistance provider. You know, I was approached to consult on a play that was running locally, that was set in a mental health facility. That was fascinating. And then I think about, you know, the work I've done with you, talking about these podcasts, the teaching work that I've done, the research. You know, it's presented a lot of possibilities, and you know, there's still more to come, and I'm interested in what's next, and enjoying the journey.
Thank you very much for talking to me today and for bringing all of your expertise and specialism, and especially talking about your PhD and starting that off, and I wish you all the best with that.
Thank you, Helen. It's been an absolute pleasure.
That was UKCP's psychotherapist Melissa Cliff speaking to Helen Willingham, our Head of Content and Engagement. If you're interested in exploring training, then you can visit our psychotherapy training page, where you can find information on psychotherapy as a career, as well as the different training pathways available to you. Just go to www.psychotherapy.org.uk/psychotherapy-training. All episodes of My Psychotherapy Career are available on our website, psychotherapy.org.uk. You can also subscribe to our channel, UKCP, on your favourite streaming platform. Do you have any feedback you'd like to share with us on this episode, or any from our series? Get in touch with us at communications@ukcp.org.uk. Join us again next month. Till then, thank you for listening and take good care of yourselves.